It's wonderful to be here. This is my first AASH meeting. AASH meeting. Forgive me. It's great to be here among you. Looking forward to meeting some of you and learning a lot more about how climate change affects plants and cultivars. I'm not at all an expert on the agriculture side or the plant side, so I'm going to be focusing on weather and climate and leaving the rest to the experts that follow me. With that, I will proceed. And by the way, if any of you are interested in my blog, it's at the Weather Underground website. Yeah, you can just look for Dr. Jeff Masters. He's the one who founded the blog, and I joined this year as a co-blogger with Jeff. After about 25 years writing and editing at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder. So I've had my foot in weather and climate research for quite a while. The two pictures, by the way, were taken within several weeks of each other in February and March. As you might guess, the one on the left is from Hollister, California. The one on the right is from Freeport, Maine. So that's ice on the coast. I'll get into this kind of warm west, cold east contrast later in the talk. So just to give you a sense of what I'll be going over the next 40 minutes or so, a little bit about the big picture and kind of why climate change matters and why we know it's happening. Touch on some recent trends and a little bit of what recent assessments are saying about the future. Some emerging themes that are popping up in what we're seeing happen. Also a few wild cards. Any big process like this is going to have a few surprises along the way. And finally, just a couple of thoughts on what we might do, knowing what we know. So this is one of my favorite statements about climate and weather. How many of you can complete this? Climate is what you expect. Weather is what you get. The most cited source for this is a Robert Heinlein novel from the 1970s, I believe. Now, this is an ice storm, a freezing rainstorm that struck central Nebraska around Christmas roughly 10 years ago. They'd never had an ice storm at that time of year of this intensity. So a good example of a weather event that happens out of season. And I think that's one of the cardinal things with climate change. Sometimes it's not so much that it's a phenomenon, a weather event we haven't seen before, but it's happening at an unusual time of the year. So 2015 is quite a year in the world of climate change. I think as you probably heard, there are major negotiations underway leading up to a big UN meeting in December that will take place in Paris. And that will be coming up with probably the next global treaty that will succeed the Kyoto Protocol. So we'll see how that evolves. But on the atmospheric venue, there has also been a lot going on. This map shows temperature anomalies, departures from normal for the last century. It goes through 2014, and you can see the red peak at the end. That was 2014. It was the warmest year in more than a century of record keeping. This is for land and ocean combined. The ocean temperatures basically related to the air temperatures over the water. So there's 2014. You can see that if we ever did have a real hiatus in global warming, as we've heard so much about, it wasn't much of one. There was a spike in temperatures in, 1998 with the strong El Nino, then a dip with the La Nina. If you average that out, it's been pretty smooth, slight leveling off in the last 15 years. During that period, a lot more heat was being taken up by the oceans than usual. It looks like now the next 15, 20 years or so, it's possible that the oceans will be releasing some of that heat as we go into the positive mode of something called the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. So in a nutshell, we can expect, I think, temperatures to spike even more the next decade or so, and probably more El Nino action than we've seen in a while. And this year is a great example of that, with the strong El Nino developing. Typically, in the second year of an El Nino, temperatures are warmer than the first year when it's a major one. So we can expect that this year is almost certainly going to be warmer than 2014. I won't be surprised if 2016 is even warmer than 2015. So we're going to see this jump pretty dramatically. So let's talk in general terms about climate change for a minute, but I want to get beyond the debate. This photo is from 2009 when I was at the Copenhagen Climate Summit. Quite a wild scene and kind of depressing in terms of not a lot of action happening. But rather than focus on this, is it natural or not, is it human caused or not, I'd rather think of it in terms of probabilities. We're used to thinking of probabilities when we think about rainfall, right? We don't say, will it rain or not tomorrow? If we're thinking about it smartly, we say, well, what's the chance of rain tomorrow? Is it 30%? Is it 80%? So where do we have the most confidence and the least confidence in climate change projections? And what can we reasonably extrapolate from things that we're already seeing now in terms of what to think about for tomorrow and the next year, the next several decades and beyond? So let's look again at some big picture factors that are always important to keep in mind. Carbon dioxide is real. You know, we can't see it, we can't smell it, we can't taste it. It's abstract, right? And I think some of the hardest things to deal with as humans facing a problem is something abstract, right? It's so easy to ignore. But this stuff is heavy, and it absorbs heat. Flowing up from the ground, it traps some of that heat and returns some of it to the atmosphere and to Earth. We generate about 30 pounds every day on average for every person on the planet. That's how much CO2 we produce. So if you multiply that, we're talking 30 billion metric tons per year. Now, if you imagine if automobiles produced CO2 in a way that we could see, if you think about it, say 130 years ago, you would get around by horse and buggy, right? Well, you would see those emissions, right? I mean, you not only see them, you'd smell them. Well, imagine if cars every few feet would spit out a chunk of charcoal, right? Well, they're doing that. You just don't see it. It's going up in the air, but it has mass and it's real. Climate change was not spun up, 20 or 30 years ago as a plot, as many people hear. If you read comments on climate change articles on the web, you'll see that all the time. It's a plot that's been hatched. Someone the other day accused me on a blog of being part of the United Nations Agenda 21. So 1824, first calculations that Earth would be far colder if it didn't have an atmosphere. 1896, the first projections of doubling CO2, how much that would warm the atmosphere. And Arrhenius at the time thought that would be a good thing, right? Because more things would grow and people would be happier. So sometimes a lot of a good thing can be not such a good thing. And of course, in 1958, Charles David Keeling from Scripps started the very first regular CO2 measurements on top of Mauna Loa, Hawaii, and the pristine air located there. That has given us what we often call the Keeling curve. This is simply showing the increase year over year in the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And it's expressed in parts per million. And the sawtooth pattern is literally the breathing of the planet, breathing of the atmosphere. It shows because we have more land area in the northern hemisphere than the southern, as vegetation grows and decays, you get spikes during different seasons. And so it goes up and down, but along with that sawtooth, you have the gradual rise. We are now just starting to dip back down below 400. We're in this mode now where part of the year CO2 concentrations are above 400 ppm, part of the year they're below. It looks like we'll have about two more years of that, and then we will be above 400 from then on for the foreseeable future. And just to give you a historical perspective, if any of you have seen the movie The Inconvenient Truth, you've seen this graphic. This is when Al Gore got up on the giant stepladder or a forklift. So 2014, compared to the last 800,000 years, we are in uncharted territory by long shot. The pattern of ice ages is evident. CO2 and temperature rise and fall, not necessarily always with CO2 leading temperature. Sometimes warming happens and then the CO2 responds to that warming. The warming or cooling might happen because of well-understood changes in how Earth orbits the sun, and that appears to be the cause of the regularity of the ice ages. So either temperature or CO2 can lead, but they tend to work in concert once they get rolling. But how many of you have heard someone say, couldn't it all just be a cycle, right? Well, it would be comforting to think that. It would sure be nice to think, well, this temperature rise last 100 years, it's just a natural cycle, right? Well, we know of a lot of cycles that are natural, right? Every day we experience one. It gets cold, it gets warm over a few days. Winter's cold, summer's warm. El Niño and La Niña tend to follow each other every several years. We have multi-decadal ocean patterns. The one I mentioned earlier, Pacific decadal, is really multi-decadal, The Atlantic appears to have something like that. Over centuries, there's warm periods and cold periods, and ice age just every 100,000 years, right? These are all cyclic. So why can't what we're seeing now be cyclic? Well, the problem is there's no identifiable process that would be causing this warming to be cyclic. And if it were, then we'd have to explain why carbon dioxide isn't warming the atmosphere, right? You'd have to explain away the carbon dioxide and find this other mystery process that is warming us up. Here's a really important point. This is modeling done at my former workplace, National Center for Atmospheric Research, along with the Department of Energy. This is a few years old, but the models are still consistent with this message. If you take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere over the last 100 years, take the increase away as if we weren't burning fossil fuel, then you would get the blue lines, and that's relatively steady temperatures in the last 50 years. If you put the carbon dioxide in, you get the rise. And to me, that's a pretty compelling piece of evidence that it's what we're doing. It's what we're putting into the air. So let's move on to some trends. And the next couple of graphs are very dense, so don't panic. I just like to focus on the center map of the United States, and then maybe the one at the upper right that says U.S. average. What we're looking at is the amount of warming over about the last century, expressed by looking at the period 1991 to 2012, those last 20 years or so, and comparing that to the first part of the 20th century. So if you compare those two periods, how much warming do you see? Well, most of the nation has warmed measurably, in some cases pretty significantly. A lot of places have warmed more than a degree Fahrenheit. You can see a little pocket pretty close to here in the southeast U.S. that has not warmed as much. Sometimes this is called the warming hole, and there's been a lot of research on it. It seems to be abating a little bit, but you can see on the graphic on the southeast there was quite a dramatic dip in temperatures in around the 50s, 60s, 70s. So that appears to be a big part of what was going on. It could be because of a lot of aerosols being put out post-war. In any event, most of the country is warm, just like most of the planet is warm. Things are a bit more of a patchwork when it comes to precipitation. But you see right away this corridor of moistening all the way up through the Great Plains, the upper Midwest, and on into the Northeast. And this echoes actually what's been going on this year, as we'll see in a little while. Record rainfall for this a lot of this year across some of those areas. You can also see it's dried in Arizona, New Mexico, parts of Southern California. But a lot of California has actually moistened if you just look purely at these two periods. But that moistening actually smooths out variability, which has gotten pretty intense, as we'll see, from year to year and every few years. So it's especially important with precipitation to be sure of what you're looking at. Is it a yearly average? Is it a bunch of years averaged together? So one of the more robust findings over the last 10 or 15 years is that the wet days are getting wetter. This graph, and I think you may see this again later on this afternoon, it's from the National Assessment, as are the couple graphics I showed earlier. So this is looking at the observed change in percentage change in the wettest days, the wettest 1% of days from 1958 to 2012. And the big message here is that it's getting wetter faster the further northeast you go in the United States. 71% increase in the northeast U.S. in the amount of precipitation falling on those very wet days. Not so much change in the southwest in those wet days, but all of the country is seeing at least some increase. Now, as I move into the part of the talk going into the future, well, we have to talk about something called RCPs, and it's kind of an ugly acronym. It stands for Representative Concentration Pathways. And these are essentially scenarios, and you've probably heard of climate scenarios. It's an attempt to look at not only what's going to happen to our climate, but what are we going to be doing? You know, how much fuel will we be burning, and how much emissions will that fuel be putting out? So obviously that's a guessing game. We really don't know how society is going to respond. But we have to make some stabs at speculating. So these are four different kind of storylines. And they go from the green to the red. The green is RCP3, or 2.6 rather. And that's kind of the most optimistic, we're going to fix this scenario. It involves pretty massive change to our, our society in terms of what we would burn. This is like essentially getting rid of most of our fossil fuel burning in the next several decades. Under this scenario, you can see that the amount of CO2 equivalent, which is pretty close to the CO2, the Keeling curve we saw earlier, it goes up to about 450 and then levels out by the middle of this century. The less optimistic scenarios are still pretty close to that around mid-century, and then they spread out after 2040. The red, as you might guess, is what we call business as usual. That's the track we're on now, and where we'll end up if we keep doing what we do. And you can see, especially after mid-century, it really soars up to three times the amount of CO2 we have now. That would probably have pretty major, if not devastating, consequences for parts of the planet. So keep this in mind. RCPs, the main thing to remember is that the larger the number on the RCP, the more kind of dire the scenario is, and the more the assumption that we're going to burn more fuel. Okay, so first, temperature projections. And these are, again, from the U.S. National Assessment that was finalized and published last year. So this is the four different RCPs, looking at the last three decades of the current century, comparing them to the last three of the 20th century. What do we see? Well, it's warming up, no surprise there. And really no surprise that the higher the RCP, the more warming you see. Warming is a little more focused to the north, consistent with the idea that the poles are and higher latitudes are already seeing more warming than lower latitudes. Now, impacts don't necessarily relate to that, because in the tropics, even a small amount of warming can take them into climate ranges that they're not used to. Whereas at northern latitudes, there's a lot of variability in climate already baked in, so a change there may not produce as many days or months that are outside the observed range. So there's some nuance there. What about precipitation? There's more model uncertainty in precipitation. Models struggle more to depict rain and snow, in part because a lot of rain and snow, as you might expect, falls in heavy showers and thunderstorms, and those are still difficult for climate models to depict and resolve. But with that caveat in mind, we can see that the mildest of the RCPs doesn't show gigantic changes in precipitation, but the higher end RCP does. But across both of them, the one thing that's pretty consistent is wetter to the north and drier and somewhat drier to the south. It's the drier to the south part is the more uncertain part, but certainly Canada is going to trend wetter, it seems. Looks like Mexico is likely to trend drier, especially in the higher emission scenarios. We're kind of in the middle in the United States, so there are differences depending on what part of the country you're in and how strong the RCP ends up being. Certainly it looks pretty dire for Southern California in the winter and spring in the higher RCP. So I think precipitation we have to take with a little bit more grain of salt, but there's more to that story, as we'll see in just a minute. Emerging themes. Well, there's one in particular I really want to talk about, and that's the question you probably often hear or maybe have gotten yourself, is climate change causing drought? This report, you may have heard about it, came out at the end of last year. It was a pretty comprehensive analysis, a very good one, of what was behind the drought in California. And, of course, it was looking at the drought from 2011 to 2014, and this past year was the worst yet in the drought. But a really important finding was that it was mostly natural variability producing the drought. But when you say drought in this context, we're talking purely meteorological drought. You know, how much rain fell, how much snow fell. This isn't talking about impacts, just the water coming from the sky. So it doesn't look right now as if there's a strong climate change component to that, to the water coming down. That got most of the headlines, right? There are a lot of headlines saying climate change not part of Colorado or California drought, or a drought not related to climate change. But buried in the conclusion, they point out future hydroclimate may nonetheless experience a reduction in surface moisture, as a projected increase in evapotranspiration is larger than the projected increase in precipitation. So this is pointing out that a number of models do show that California may get wetter, but it's going to get warmer, and that's going to cause more evaporation. And we're seeing that happen really in a devastating way already. Not only in California. This is from the Texas drought of 2011, which was a phenomenal event there. I believe something like 10% of all the trees were estimated to have been killed And I believe that's both rural and urban areas in Texas. So this is looking at a graph that shows rainfall across the x-axis and temperature on the y-axis. So each dot represents how much rain fell and how hot it was in a given year. This is from 1895 to 2011. As you might expect, the years that are drier are also warmer. But look at the upper left, you see a big orange dot. That was 2011. So it's not just at the upper left end, it's way off the upper left end. And it was both, it was definitely drier than any other year, but it was a lot hotter. Okay, what about California? These two graphs really, I'm still stunned by them. This is precipitation, and we're looking at essentially the water year here. So it's from July to June for each pair of years going back to the 1895, I believe. What do you see? Well, lots of year-to-year variability, of course. Here's the drought, the last 4 years, all well below average. Although this last winter was not quite so dry as the previous one. There were some good rainfall events, especially in December. So to me, this says, well, the drought, if you define it as the amount of rain, has been strong and it's been very prolonged, but it doesn't really jump out compared to some of these earlier ones. It's on par, I would say, with them. But now let's look at temperature. So this drought is not like the 1970s when it comes to temperature, right? I mean, these are phenomenal anomalies when you're looking at an entire state for an entire year. The past year has been something like, about a degree warmer than last year, which was warmer than any other year on record. So truly, truly amazing. So what's going on? Well, a really important study, led by Noah Deffenbaugh at Stanford, published in PNAS a few months ago, looked at this relationship between temperature and drought and found that human emissions have increased the probability that low precipitation years are also warm, suggesting that anthropogenic warming is increasing the probability of the co-occurring warm and dry conditions that have created the current California drought. Now here's an example of where the term drought gets squishy, right? You have to be ultra clear what do you mean by drought. I think in this quote they're talking about the drought including its impacts, not the pure rain and snow, because as we saw earlier, it's not the warm and dry conditions, it's simply been, you know, warm. And the dryness is there but not off the charts, the warmth is off the charts. And this study found by using not just observations but models that this is what you'd expect to happen. As the climate overall warms, when it's dry, it gets a lot hotter. And by the way, if you can't read it, the two pictures, the one in the upper left is the Sierra Snowpack Survey conducted at the end of the snow season. The top one is from the end of 2013, and the bottom one is from April of 2015. And you can see the snow survey this year had no snow to survey. It was unprecedented. Here's something else that really knocked my socks off. This is rainfall. Are any of you from Texas or Oklahoma? I see one. Good. I grew up in Oklahoma. I went to college in Texas, so this is an area dear to my heart, and it was wet there. How wet was it? Well, these are the top 10 wet months for the last century, and you can see for Oklahoma and Texas that May was not just, you know, the wettest, but by a long shot. I mean, look at this. It was the next 9 months are in Oklahoma or something like 8.5 to 10.5 inches. May this year had 14.5 inches. In Texas, we go from number 10 had 6.18 inches, number 2 had 6.66 inches. So they're all pretty tightly clustered in that 6-inch range. This year, May had 8.81 inches, right? But John Nielsen Gammon, who's the state climatologist for Texas, did a back-of-the-envelope calculation and estimated that this departure in May is something you would expect to see once every 2,000 years in a stationary climate. By the way, June was also the wettest June on record across the whole belt from Illinois to Ohio. And it stayed pretty wet across a big chunk of the center of the country. It's also led to very humid conditions and warm nights, as a lot of you know. I don't have to tell you that. Here's another way to look at what happened in Oklahoma and Texas. There are places that went from the most intense meteorological or Palmer drought category to no drought in 30 days. I don't think I've ever seen that happen before. So as we saw a few minutes ago, we do know that when you get down to the one-day scale, there's a lot of evidence and research showing that those wet spells are getting wetter. We don't know so much when we're looking at periods of, say, a month. Are those tending to become more common, the very wet and very dry periods lasting a month? I'm not aware of a lot of work on that time scale. Hopefully that'll be done. I think the data's out there, just hasn't been analyzed in that time frame. One thing that's very evident from looking at the data is that nights are getting warmer. June of this year was the warmest June across the nation in terms of overnight lows. I want to look now at temperatures for the U.S. These are national averages for the whole year, but we'll look at three different portrayals. One is the combines daytime and nighttime, so it's the average full day temperature. The trend is 1.32 degrees Fahrenheit per century, right? Now, if we look at just maxima, so this is averaging all the daytime highs. The trend is not quite so great. It's about 1.18 Fahrenheit, a little bit less, a little bit flatter curve, although still obviously increasing. If we look at warm nights, it becomes more dramatic. Trend here is 1.45 degrees Fahrenheit. And you can see that especially in the last 20 years or so, since about 1990, we've mostly been in a very warm overnight temperature range. A little bit of a dip that year, but so to me, this is just one of many pieces of evidence telling us that nights are getting warmer. And obviously, this has major implications for growing things. Okay, as the siren goes, let's talk about some wild cards. Very appropriate. It can't be stressed enough. The United States is not the world. We are less than 10% of the world's area, less than 10% of the land area, and certainly way less than 10% of the surface area. These are temperature departures from normal for February of this year. And the thing that jumps out like a sore thumb is, look how cold it was in eastern North America. To me, in a warming climate, this is truly astounding. Talking about colder than 4 degrees Celsius below the norm across a large area, so 7 degrees Fahrenheit. Lots of incredible warmth over the planet, especially in higher latitudes of the northern hemisphere, but it was cold in the east. Why? It's a burning question. A lot of folks are looking carefully at this. One hypothesis is that we've lost so much Arctic sea ice, especially in the summer and fall, that is actually torquing the jet stream. And through a variety of different processes, that's, in these researchers' eyes, leading to reduced temperature gradients and what's sometimes called jet stream weirding, where the jet stream locks into meridional patterns, stays there for weeks or months. But there's another camp of researchers, one of them, Dennis Hartman at the University of Washington, that are focusing on what's going on out in the Pacific, and in particular, an area in what's called the Pacific Warm Pool, the warmest waters on Earth on average, the western tropical Pacific. Separate from El Nino and La Nina, there's an area that appears to have really gotten warm the last several years, and their thinking is that's set up what you call a wave train of high pressure and low pressure, and they believe that has played a big role in this tendency toward high pressure and warmth out here, and cold low upper level low pressure and cold over in the east. It's possible both of these are playing out, and there may be a dash of just natural variability in the mix. I think the next several years are going to be really compelling, especially this winter, because we have a strong El Nino that tends to make this part of the country, the Midwest and East, there's a strong tendency for it to be warmer than average. But the last several years have tended to be pretty cool, so which one will win? Grab some popcorn and we shall see. So just a couple of tidbits on extreme weather. This isn't quite as related to crops, but I thought you might enjoy them. What happened to major hurricanes? Believe it or not, the last time the United States was hit by a Category 3 hurricane was Hurricane Wilma in 2005. So it's been 10 years now. There's never been a period since modern records began of that long a spell. The closest thing was in the 1860s. Of course, records were a little dicier back then. There may have been a little bit more Cat 3 action than we thought, but clearly something pretty unusual has happened in terms of landfalls. Now, what's interesting is that there has been no lack of hurricanes in the Atlantic. There's been plenty of them. They just have not been coming into the U.S. Another interesting facet is that we've certainly had storm surge that's been comparable to a major hurricane. Ike that hit Louisiana or hit Galveston in 2008, and Sandy in particular. The storm surge with Sandy is estimated to have been equivalent to the amount of water that was pushed ashore by Katrina, right? So, and Katrina technically was only a Category 3 when it made landfall, but the storm surge associated with these large systems, and Sandy was a very large hurricane, Ike was, so was Isaac. What we're seeing are larger hurricanes where the energy, instead of being focused in extremely high winds, is spread out over a larger area. No telling whether this is a climate trend or just something funky of the last few years, but we are seeing more of those landfalls. So you have to keep that in mind when that this is referring only to Category 3 as measured by wind speed. I'm starting to wonder, though, whether we might be entering a period that will produce less hurricanes out in the Atlantic for, say, 10 or 20 years. We've seen periods like that from the 1960s into the mid-1990s had much less activity than we saw from 1995 onward. Dr. Bill Gray at Colorado State believes there is a natural process involving Atlantic thermohaline circulation that controls this. There is some skepticism about that, but just empirically looking at the data, there certainly are more active and less active periods lasting decades. So I think it's going to be interesting to see if we have begun such an era. And if so, how do we keep people vigilant? There's a study that just came out this week looking at hurricane awareness in Florida and how it's starting to dip a little, right? They had such a major hurricane activity in 2004, 2005, and then it's gotten quiet, and a lot of people have moved to Florida since then. Also very interesting things happening with tornado season. We had a terrible season in 2011, the Deep South outbreak in late April, and the Joplin tornado, the deadliest single tornado in almost 100 years. It's been pretty quiet since then. We've had some very quiet years. The first 3 or 4 months of this year were pretty much dead in terms of severe weather, unprecedentedly so in modern records. So there seems to be a more variability happening, and some scientists, including James Elsner at Florida State, are looking into this. I think another kind of wild card open question is what's going to happen to the ends of the temperature distribution as it warms up? This is a study by Jim Hansen a couple years back. What he did was he looked at what they consider the reference period 1951 to 1980, and this is the temperature distribution. As you expect, as you get out to the ends, when you have very warm or very cold periods, it tails off, so there's fewer events and a lot more events in the center. It's a classic bell curve, and a very patriotic one, I might add, the red, white, and blue. But what happens to that curve as we get into recent decades? Well, this is 2001 to 2011. You can see the curve, it's done two things. One, it shifted over, as we kind of expect, but it's also broadened. So not only do we have more warm periods and less cold, as you'd expect, but this long tail is becoming longer. And that has an effect on how many of the really, really warm events we'll see. I think California this year is a really good example of that. It's so far above the distribution. So this is an open question. There hasn't been a lot of work done on how much that variability will change in the future. Megadrought. I don't want to get into this too much because there's pretty intricate science. I'm not an expert in this by any means, but there are natural causes for megadroughts. They have happened in the past, periods of depleted rainfall lasting decades. They've happened in the southwest U.S., central plains, Great Plains. So we can expect that there's always the risk of a mega drought through those natural processes, largely involving sea surface patterns in the Pacific, like I mentioned earlier. But what will a warming atmosphere do to naturally occurring droughts? Rather scary study published by Benjamin Cook earlier this year in the journal Science Advances found a really high chance of a mega drought this century, toward the century's end, not only in the Southwest but in the Great Plains. And they're speculating that the risk will be even higher than it was during the 1100s, 1200s, when the Anasazi people essentially disappeared from the Mesa Verde area. And this is true, they found not only for high RCP, but for moderate as well. So if what they found is the case, we'll have real trouble avoiding that enhanced risk. I think this paper is somewhat controversial also, but definitely worth thinking about. So I'll wrap up with just a couple of observations. I think these are pretty established things. We can expect heat waves to get longer and more intense. And again, as that long tail gets longer, it's something we'll really have to watch for. And heat waves may have more periods of very, very warm nights. And it's already well established that fatalities go up during heat waves when the nights are extremely warm because people have less chance to cool off, especially if they're in a city without air conditioning. When droughts do occur, even if they're kind of natural droughts, the impacts are going to be exacerbated by the higher temperatures that climate change is producing. We're already seeing rain and snow falling in heavier bursts and longer dry spells in between. That should continue. And more than ever, we have to remember that these are not going to be straight line trends. There's going to be departures. We can expect surprises like the cold east. I mean, nobody really predicted that New York State this year was going to have the coldest January to March they've ever had on record. I still can't believe that happened. So expect the unexpected to a certain extent, but also keep in mind these trends on the large scale will continue. What do we do? A lot of this is pretty obvious. To reduce our longer term risk, we've got to reduce emissions. There's a lot of ways we could do that. I think Paris will start pointing us toward that direction. It's a huge problem, though, a huge global challenge that's probably going to be with us the rest of our lives. But that won't help us much in the near term, and I think subsequent talks today are going to get into this. In the near term, we're not going to change how those scenarios depart, so we really have to adapt. We've got to look closely at what's happening and what will probably happen in the next several decades and start to deal with that. Even if we turned off every engine now, there is some amount of warming that's simply baked in because of heat that's already been absorbed in the oceans. As I pointed out, expect the unexpected as we're coming up with this mix of natural variations with a warmer atmosphere. I think this El Nino coming up this winter is a great example of that. Jennifer Francis at Rutgers has pointed out we have never seen an El Nino occur at the same time as the amount of ice in the Arctic is so low. I mean, we simply have not had that constellation of variables happen before in our knowledge. So we will have to see what happens. And finally, just as a tip of my hat to the plant world, asynchrony is going to be something we'll have to deal with. When plants and insects intersect in ways that are controlled both by the amount of warmth in the springtime and the amount of light, some respond to light more, some to warmth more. Those may not intersect in the same ways, so that could lead to some trouble. So if I'm going to conclude with one statement, I think it would be, please don't think of weather events as being caused by climate change, but do think of them as all happening within this context of a changing climate. Some websites, my former employer, UCAR, we have what I think is an excellent FAQ all about climate change and global warming. Just go to ucar.edu. IPCC and U.S. National Assessment are fantastic resources, especially the introductions if you don't have time or inclination to dive too deeply. I'm really enjoying climate.gov these days, which is NOAA's website. They have some excellent blogs that are very, very accessible and actually entertaining. There's an ENSO blog on El Nino Southern Oscillation that's fantastic. There's also, if you have climate doubters, contrarians among folks you know, and you want to answer something they keep asking you, there's a website called Skeptical Science that is dynamite. It's got something like 100 questions with pithy answers. They're actually answered at several levels, beginning, intermediate, advanced. So you can just find the one that fits. And they're not patronizing. They're very down to earth, very well done. But like any author, I, of course, have to flog my own book. So available on Amazon or find bookstores near you, The Thinking Person's Guide to Climate Change. This was originally published as The Rough Guide to Climate Change in 2006. So it's essentially the fourth edition of The Rough Guide, but we just changed publishers. It's now published by the American Meteorological Society. So thank you for your time, and I'm really looking forward to hearing what our next speakers have to say about how all this affects your world. Thank you.
schedule. If there's some short questions, burning questions that aren't going to lead to the later table debates. Yeah. Cool.
Robert, at this meeting, we have some instrument companies that give us ways to measure weather and climate. And those have changed a lot over the decades. Better instrumentation, more accurate. And sort of in the case of something like temperature, you know that urbanization has made some of our weather stations warmer. People, that's well known. And also the instruments get better at more precisely measuring. If you go back 100 years, as you alluded to, the data gets sketchy as far as that goes. Have you gotten into the instrumentation and the correction factors that are used in this?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. A gentleman asked about changes in instrumentation and how instruments are built and placed over the last, say, century, and urban heat islands, and how those might affect the overall temperature rise and such. Yes, I have looked a little bit into that. There was a study that got some attention several years ago by Anthony Watts, who has a website called What's Up With That, a pretty skeptical-oriented site on climate change. And he and colleagues did a study looking at where weather stations are located, especially at Weather Service facilities. And they found some pretty egregious examples that were stations were warmed simply by being near too much concrete, for example. So that was certainly an important point, and I think those findings are being addressed. In response to that, NOAA did an analysis to see, well, how much might this be affecting the national trend? And when you weed out those problematic stations, it has very little impact because there are so many other rural stations around the country. And those are regularly corrected for in the analysis. Sometimes that's called cooking the books, but it's actually making the books more accurate because you're removing the stations that are problematic because they're badly sited or whatever. When you take those out, the trend really doesn't change that much. I mean, the other, I think, argument in terms of whether this affects really, whether we might be misreading the data, is that we have so many natural thermometers. You know, we have melting ice, we have changes in plants that all point in the same direction of warmth. So I think it's really important that stations be sited well. There's actually a movement at NOAA to create what's called a climate reference network, which are, I think, on the order of about 100, like, gold standard stations. They're perfectly sited. They're not going to have any of these issues. And top-notch instrumentation, and they'll just be there from now on. But instruments are certainly a huge problem. I mean, in my hometown of Boulder, the weather station moved 4 or 5 times in the 20th century, and there are many small-scale changes in precipitation from one side of town to the other. The station was on top of a roof during the heat wave of the 1950s, so those records are probably out to lunch. So certainly from place to place you have problems. When you average all those out and you get rid of the egregious ones, it's definitely warming.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you.